Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for December 13th, 2015. I'm your host, Dave McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, let's start out. The big news of the weekend, I believe, was the latest Des Moines Register Iowa poll. And it was anticipated because there's a pollster, Ann Seltzer, who they apparently say that, you know, she has the demographics of Iowa put down better and can poll that state either side of the aisle better than anyone else. And so the poll's coming out. And, of course, it was interesting because it showed a change in that race. Ted Cruz, which I think a lot of people had since had been gaining momentum, has taken the lead over Donald Trump, over Ben Carson, over Marco Rubio. I don't think Marco Rubio ever had the lead, but he passed up the other two in this poll. Tim, I'm sure you saw it yet last night. What did you make of the numbers?
Cruz is probably benefiting, I think, from Dr. Carson's collapse. There are a lot of evangelical voters in the Republican Party. There are a bunch of them, as a matter of fact. These are the people like that propelled Pat Robertson years ago to a second place finish in that state. These are the people that helped Mike Huckabee win and Rick Santorum win. So they're a very viable force in the Republican Party. And now those voters are gravitating from Dr. Carson over to Cruz, to the point that Cruz may almost certainly be about to win this thing in Iowa, unless his latest gaffe that I'm sure we'll talk about in a few minutes, one of those deals where he didn't know he was being recorded, came out. The establishment is what troubles me there, but they got to be getting a bit antsy because Cruz to them is even less acceptable, I guess, than is Trump. And no strong establishment candidate is stepping forward. As we mentioned before we came on the air, you got to go all the way back to 10%. To find an establishment candidate. So that's where it seems to be standing right now.
Yeah, well, Catherine, could it be that what is the establishment in the Republican Party has changed?
I think that's absolutely part of a likely explanation. My thoughts about this are, you know, I think it just seems like Ted Cruz is universally unliked. On a personal level, it's hard to find anybody. I'm sure his mother loves him, and I just wonder if you know he may have an early surge in the primaries and caucuses, but once people get to know him and his apparently unpleasant personality gets more attention, I think he may lose some of that support.
Yeah, I have another question for y'all. Ted Cruz comes from Texas. And if there's a state in the country, I think, that embodies what the new Republican Party is or what they want to be, they want to be this independent, you know, Sunbelt-centric party, it's Texas. Do you think that, Tim, I'll ask you first, do you think that the Texas stamp of approval helps him?
Well, it certainly helped him get to the U.S. Senate. I'm not sure if there's any place where a Cuban-American born in Canada as conservative as he is, yet educated at an Ivy League school, could find strong political footing in any other state. But he has done so in Texas, and that's a pretty good base if you're a Republican to operate from, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and Kath, that's what I'm thinking. You know, George Bush kind of had that, you know, George W. Bush had the Texas legacy. His father had it. Then Rick Perry felt he would use that to be the nominee. So you've had two of the past, or the past two Republican presidents have both held from Texas, and now Ted Cruz is the front runner. Is there something to this Texas pedigree for Republicans?
I think there might be, but I think that, I mean, I think we want, I mean, this has been one of the criticisms from the right of the president, that he was so elite, of the president, current President Obama. He's so elite, you know, he's he's an intellectual, la, 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 la. And didn't appear to be that likable. Whereas with George Bush, George W. Bush, that was the thing, you know, he was likable. Everybody wanted to have a beer with him. I mean, obviously, he didn't run against President Obama. I'm just talking about presidents and this expectation that they're going to be like nice, ordinary guys. And I don't think Ted Cruz has that reputation at all. And I just think that this could be a flash in the pan because of his personality flaws, apparently, apparent personality flaws. Whether he's from Texas or wherever, I just think that at some point that might catch up with him and make him less electable.
Yeah, and I mean, I just juxtapose this against two of their other, I guess you'd say, top-tier candidates, if you tiers at least five candidates. You got two Floridians, a swing state, and those guys are not doing that well. Jeb Bush honestly couldn't do worse. And
oh, yeah,
then Marco Rubio, he had a little bit of for a while, and he's gone away. So they're staying away from swing states for a state like Texas. If they don't win it, they're never going to get anywhere. It'd be like Democrats in California. If you don't win it, you don't have a winning coalition. Tim?
Well, what's going to have to happen with the, quote, establishment candidates? Is that they are going to have their voters are going to have to coalesce behind one person. When you're talking about, like in Iowa, you're talking about Rubio sitting there at 10%, Bush at 6, Christie at 3, but then you move over to New Hampshire and Christie is starting the surge. This one is doing okay in one state. This one's doing okay in another state. But none of them are running better than third or fourth in any state. Their voters are going to have to coalesce behind one candidate. The herd has got to thin out a little bit so that they can take on these outsiders. That's what's going to have to happen. So I haven't, you know, discounted the notion that an establishment candidate is going to win the nomination yet. I just still can't believe that the Republican Party would give their nomination to Donald Trump without a fight.
You know,
well,
that's the thing.
But here's something interesting about this poll, and Catherine, I'll let you respond to that, to what I'm going to say, too, and whatever else. New York Times looked at that poll, and they found out they had some questions in there. 60% of our nearly 6 in 10 say climate change is a hoax. I mean, just believe none of it. More than half want mass deportation of illegal immigrants. 6 in 10 says no IRS. I mean, I don't even know how you collect money to fund the government, whichever part you might want, even be in the military. Catherine, does this show that establishment, I mean, these people, this is over half the Republican Party on these issues, and I don't think we would consider these anywhere near mainstream opinions for the whole electorate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those are definitely fringe opinions. But they're fomenting this, all this stuff. You know, they're, you know, with Donald Trump talking about immigrants and A lot of talk about the IRS. I think Ben Carson talked about it. I don't remember who else. But they always talk about how awful the IRS is. It's not a new subject for them. But when you talk about it enough, then people say, well, let's get rid of it instead of you know, changing whatever the tax code might be, if that's what your thing is. But what I was going to say about the interesting thing about the caucuses in Iowa is that oftentimes the operatives on the ground are working together, like different candidates' operatives will be like, okay, well, if my guy or gal isn't winning in that caucus, my people will come to your people. My people will come to your candidate. You know, that was how what's his name? Mr. Pretty Face, Edwards won the caucus, I don't remember if he won or came close in 2004, was that he got all the what's that guy's name, that peace-loving guy from Ohio? Kucinich. All the Kucinich caucus goers went to Edwards. They made a deal. Edwards and Kucinich, or his operatives on the ground, made a deal. And so Edwards got all the Kucinich support in the second round of caucus ballots. So that's the interesting thing about those caucuses, is that there can be all kinds of deals going on that we don't know about because they don't talk about them. It's usually somewhat of a surprise on caucus night where those losing candidates, caucus goers end up, delegates end up.
Yeah, kind of two more things about this is, Hillary Clinton's campaign kind of came out and said, you know, talking about Iowa, that they kind of feel that Ted Cruz is going to build momentum and be the Democratic nominee. Tim, is that kind of presumptuous to go ahead and say this, or is this how they really feel, or is this like they're trying to maneuver here?
This sounds political and almost like they hope that's who it is. You notice they mentioned him and their second. They figured that the second thought on it might be Trump and then Rubio. That's what John Podesta, Hillary's campaign chair, said at a fundraiser. And I guarantee you he didn't utter those words without clearing it first with her. So I think that's who they'd love to run against, is that either Cruz or Trump. I would rather neither one of those people got the nomination in case he actually won, you know. But I don't see how they could get the nomination to one of those people. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the Republicans, if you look at some of their candidates for statewide races, I think that they could easily be one of those two. And if you talk about a presidency, the House and the Senate, they would have everything. I don't think it's going to matter which one the Republicans is. I think it's going to be an America that's quite a shock to the three of us, to say the least. Catherine, usually when they do these Des Moines Register polls, they come out with a Democratic poll and a Republican poll. They may delay them by a day. No Democratic numbers over 24 hours after the Republican numbers were released. Did they just not poll the Democrats, or were they embargoing them to like Monday, or what's up?
I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if they didn't even bother. I mean, clearly, Hillary is, you know, commanding leads in most of the polls we've seen lately, right? And even if it was, a little bit tighter than we might expect, it's not as much of news because we've only got three candidates. It's not like we've got how many ever they have, 13, 10, whatever. So I think it's just more newsworthy, the Republicans, and I'm fine with that. I just wanted to say something about John Podesta. I just think it was a mistake for him to talk about that. Like, why doesn't he just talk about Hillary or talk about being a Democrat? Like, I think it was, I don't know, I just think it draws more attention than they're already getting to the Republican candidates. And I just always feel like let them elect their guy, gal, whatever, and we'll do our business, and then we'll come together during the general, and then we can fight it out. I think it's unattractive for the party leaders and campaign leaders to be talking about the other party. But I know I'm that way.
And I think a lot of times some of these donors, they want inside information at times, and so that's where this comes, rightly or wrongly. But they, you know, they kind of want that for the money they spend on the donations. Well, let's kind of move over to another topic, and that would be Nathan Deal. And that's the governor of Georgia, for those of you outside the state of Georgia that don't necessarily keep up with our politics. And we've talked about him before because he seems to make the news a lot by doing things that are not quite above board. I don't think he's common causes, model politician by any means. And so he kind of raised the ire of the AJC this past week. I guess it was a feature in today's Sunday paper. There's a technical college in Oakwood, Georgia, which is very near but where Hall County, Gwinnett County, and Forsyth County come together. And I'm actually on Google Maps trying to find exactly, you know, where it is and things. But it's not directly in Gainesville. It's south of Gainesville, which is Nathan Deal's hometown. And he is proposing spending $100 million to build a new campus in Gainesville, moving the college about 10 miles north. And people are saying, well, look, you know, maybe there's some renovations that need doing, but it would be far cheaper to do those on the current campus site. But instead, he wants to build it and move it 10 miles north. Tim, how bad a use of taxpayers' money is this? Or is there just, you know, Lanier College just needs to move 10 miles north?
No, I think it's poor use of taxpayers' money, but it's just another example of a governor, and there's a long list of those going back, to spend money in their home counties because, well, they can't for the benefit of their base supporters, their families, their friends, whoever. This is one of a shopping list, I guess, of projects that he's got that's going to take about 20 years for the taxpayers to pay for, and this is one of those to the victors go the spoils moments, I suppose. And, you know, nobody's going to stop it either. And while we diss this guy, there are those in this state who absolutely think he's marvelous and can do no wrong. But, that's a patronage thing in your home county, moving a school 10 miles to the north before it is and spending $100 million to do it.
Yeah, and you're right about, you know, governors have done this in the past. And the AJC had a list of projects that had happened. The one that I didn't think fit in the list as much was Joe Frank Harris kind of engineered the Anheuser-Busch Budweiser plant coming to his home county of Bartow, but that did sit on I-75. It was in a piece of property that was probably not very expensive at the time. It sat halfway between major cities of Chattanooga and Atlanta, and so therefore it brought jobs, brought a good many jobs to around that area. So it wasn't like it was just some, you know, spending just for spending sake. Now, some of the other ones that they mentioned, you know, the Go Fish Center we've talked about, maybe it'll start to do better, but at the current time it is not doing well as far as, you know, tourism. Roy Barnes, Democratic governor, he had this Mabel House. They revamped it and they built an amphitheater. I've never been to a concert there, but maybe there's enough concert money to justify it. I don't really know. And then Zell Miller, they bought a state-funded resort and then a golf course near the North Georgia Mountains. All the North Georgia Mountains have really grown recently, and that kind of, you know, plays into 400 drops more people and 575. You know, there's more access than there used to be up there. So some of those projects were kind of created differently than certainly this one. Catherine, you read the article too. What did you think?
Well, I just, you know, whenever I read those articles, I can't help but think, imagine what $100 million could do if they took some of that and did the, you know, improvements on Lanier College in its current location, and then did some other, you know, took some of the money and did some other things at some other technical schools or colleges and universities or other, you know, other education spending, you know, that it could really make a difference at some of these schools and still improve the education and access and everything at Lanier College. So I can't help but think about that when I read those articles. And it's just a big disappointment to me that oftentimes our leaders are so steeped in this patronage legacy and, you know, getting their names on things and all these kind of things that we miss the opportunities to do good in more ways. So that's sort of my take on all that stuff.
And it's funny, you talk about the name. It's called Lanier Technical College. It's pretty near the banks of Lake Lanier. Now it's going to be further away from Lake Lanier, so therefore it really won't be near what it's named for. Is a little bit of irony.
Well, the other thing they mentioned in that article is that because of its current location, it draws students from, you know, a broader, more diverse, you know, from Gwinnett, from Forsyth.
Forsyth. Yeah.
And Hall. So it really does increase access in its current location. So it's a disappointment to me. But, you know, I find myself disappointed in our politicians often, so it's not a big surprise.
Yeah, and I believe it has one of the better boat repair, like engines for boats programs than a lot of the technical colleges do because of its location. So maybe they'll have a satellite campus. Because, like, I remember I took some summer classes at Clayton State, and they had a aviation program, you know, 10 miles away at down at the Clayton County Airport. And so you can move those kind of programs where you need them. So maybe that won't be lost. But if that were to be lost or the quality be lost, that'd be another detrimental thing. Well, while we're in Georgia, Catherine, you have kind of alerted us to a play or a musical that's going on that then somebody moved into a Georgia-centric history figure. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, many of our listeners may know about the new play on Broadway called Hamilton, which is the sort of biography of Alexander Hamilton. It's a huge hit. I am obsessed with it. I listen to the soundtrack pretty much daily, and it's fantastic. It's relatively historically accurate. It was written and is produced and stars Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is has been on Broadway for a while. He's had a couple of other very successful musicals, and he's quite the musical fan. And he was on Stephen Colbert the other night, on Friday night, I think. And they had a, you know, brief conversation, and then I'm watching it, and Stephen Colbert starts talking about Button Gwinnett, who's one of my favorite signers of the Declaration of Independence. He's from Georgia. He had a very brief political career and then died in a duel about a year after he signed the Declaration. And not many people know about him. And I was just like gobsmacked when I was like, "What? They're talking about Button Gwinnett on the Late Show?" And then they did a little send up of him. They did a little musical number rap. The whole Alexander Hamilton, the Hamilton show, is sort of a rap version of Alexander Hamilton's life. It's very, very good. I highly recommend it. If you haven't listened to it, you'll become obsessed as I and many of my friends are. But so they did this send-up of a little duet between John Adams and Button Gwinnett, and it was really funny and put, you know, Button Gwinnett, one of the three Georgia signers of the Declaration, in the national light. And I thought it was kind of interesting and worth mentioning on the Kudzu Vine tonight.
Yes, and see, I actually had Georgia history, so I knew about Lyman Hall and George Walton as well, that were the three signers from Georgia, and all have Georgia counties all in the same area. That's what's funny is Walton County touches Gwinnett, and Gwinnett touches Hall County, so all those signers, their counties are all right there together. I'm not sure if that was a plan, because they weren't probably from that part of Georgia, because around that time, a lot of that part of Georgia was still Native American land and hadn't, you know, gone through the treaties, some of that area. Well, Tim, any thoughts on this musical?
Yeah, I was thinking about the Hamilton end of the deal. I'm going to assume that the biography he read that, you know, set him on fire to do a musical about Hamilton probably had to be Ron Chernow's.
It is.
Biography of Hamilton, which is a marvelous, marvelous book, by the way, if you've never read it. It won the Pulitzer Prize in Book of the Year 5 or 6 years ago, and it's just a very scholarly, wonderful book. And Hamilton, he led quite the life for anybody who doesn't
Tim,
know
I
much
think
about
you would
him.
Really enjoy that soundtrack. I really do. It is so fantastic. And that's exactly what happened. Miranda was going on vacation. He picked up that book, and he read it. And after two days of reading it, he said, "Man, why hasn't anybody ever written a Broadway musical about this guy? This is a great story." And so he did.
Well, that's cute.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, speaking of great musical performers of you know, of America, another one made the news this past week, and that would be Kermit the Frog. Rainbow Connection and Not Easy Being Green.
Good segue,
and you know, Kermit is not a real controversial guy usually, but apparently there was a school board member in Marshfield, Wisconsin, and I'm not sure which part of the state that is. And talking about states, Wisconsin's just a really interesting state because you've got places like Madison that are, for the Midwest, are very, very liberal. And then you've got, obviously, Paul Ryan and Scott Walker hail from the state. And now Mary Carney, who probably is more conservative than the two of them put together, she wants to ban For Every Child, A Better World, which is a Muppet book, because it's too graphic for kindergartners. And it was written as a fundraiser for the United Nations in memory of Audrey Hepburn. And it depicts, and this is what she says, she has problems. It depicts poverty, world hunger, and altruism. I thought kind of the Bible also touches on those things. I guess she would ban that too. But, you know, it just...
Do these people just shock you sometimes?
Oh, my.
Well, I just looked up where Marshfield, Wisconsin is, and it's up in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, go ahead and tell us, yeah.
It's up near Green Bay. So there's not a lot going on up there. So maybe she, you know, had to find something to sink her teeth into, and it turned out to be Kermit.
Yeah, I'm just surprised they banned anything green in Green Bay. Tim, your thoughts?
Well, she is a Tea Party type person. And since this book's profits were going to the United Nations, I just wonder if there was some connection there that she thinks it's all part of a plot to impose one world government with Kermit the Frog as a willing participant or something. How do people, you know, I always wonder, how do people like this get elected to public office by voters who really should just know better? I mean, doesn't she sound a little bit unhinged? Somebody like that doesn't even need to be anywhere near government with all the things that they could be doing locally up there. And I'm sure there's a lot of them. this is her cause. This is why she was elected, to go after Jim Henson and the Muppets.
Yeah.
And I thought we had some characters down here. And we do, but boy, this is a good one here. Going after the Muppets.
I did see a list one time of banned books, and there was a lady on a school board in Alaska one time that wanted to ban the dictionary because of some of the words it contained. So this lady's not quite that bad, but that's close. You know, Kermit the Frog book. Because it talks about, you know, poverty and altruism. I thought altruism was a good thing. You wanted to help people, but, you know, shocking all the time. Well, let's get a little more serious and something it's probably just as shocking, but, you know, much more harmful, because I'm sure those kindergartners, when they get older, if they want to choose to read that controversial Kermit book, she won't be able to keep it out of their hands down the road. But the Supreme Court ruled and said that colleges can discriminate against GBTL students. And Carson Newman was one of the schools listed. That's up in Tennessee. There were some more. I guess it was like 18. But Carson Newman actually, I think, went further. They said not only gay, lesbian students, unwed mothers, women who've ever had an abortion, not exactly sure what type of opposition research they're putting in their college applications to find all this out, and even students who may be pregnant. You know, I don't, you know, this is pretty intrusive stuff here. I really didn't know a lot about Carson Newman, but, you know, it sounds fairly conservative. I think there's a list of more of them. Catherine, when you read this, and you may have read some other places about it too, what were your thoughts?
Well, I just don't think there's any place for those kind of discriminatory practices in a school that gets any federal money. You know, if they want to do that as a, you know, as a privately funded, you know, religious institution, I don't agree with it. I can wrap my head around that. But they're a Title X school, so they're getting federal money, and I just think it's inappropriate for I don't want my tax dollars going to a school that is discriminating against. And like you said, how do you know? How do you find out? Like, I mean, do they ask questions on the application and then, like, do a, you know, lie detector test or something? Like, how do you find out if a person, of course, what person with any of those characteristics would want to go there is another question. But still, I just don't think it's appropriate for them to be getting Title IX money.
Yeah, I think that may be the trick. Maybe they're going to have to start, you know, not taking federal money, because obviously
they got an exemption.
They got an exception. See, that seems like something that's going to have another case down the road to see there, because, you know, the one with the GBLT is going to be the one that's the clear discrimination. Some of that other stuff is going to be, how are you even going to learn about it? I mean, in some cases, it kind of shows in some of these colleges, it's almost like they're not looking at the future, they're looking at the past. I mean, they're like, oh, in the good old days, in the, you know, the 50s or whatever, this is how the way things were, and let's fight the march of time and go back there. Tim,
and let's just remember that it wasn't like that in the 50s. Okay, like,
oh, yeah.
There were still LGBT people, there were still unwed mothers, if you want to call them that, there was still abortion, there, you know, all those things existed,
yeah.
It's just that they weren't quite as in the open as they are now.
Yeah, but you know, the old view, you know, the old things were the good old days.
Right.
And, you know, in Billy Joel, the good old days weren't as good as they seemed.
No,
Tim?
They weren't.
Well, you know, Carson Newman is a Southern Baptist school, like Shorter.
Yeah.
And you know what Shorter did, and what Carson Newman did was got a Title IX waiver, as Catherine mentioned. I think there are about 30 colleges now in the country that have a Title IX waiver for some reason or another. The school says that this validates their First Amendment rights. I'm not sure where they're going there, but it's a stickly situation. And the hierarchy of this school is going to be all for doing something like this, because if I'm not mistaken, you know, any school that's a Southern Baptist school, well, then the Southern Baptist Convention pretty much runs that school and can hire and fire people at will. As we saw exhibited down there with that oath they all had to sign at Shorter a couple of years ago, right, David?
Yes, and one thing about that, and Shorter's a good example, you take away the business school that has the satellite campuses around Atlanta, and the folks, you know, it's just, it's almost like drive-through college. The people don't live at the college. There's not the campus life. And so people just come for the class and get it and go. But it's talking about the Rome campus where all the campus life is. You know, in just the last few years, enrollments dropped. Their sports programs, which they have built up to be really solid for a school that size, is just falling apart. All their coaches are leaving. Their coaches take high school jobs as opposed to college jobs. Because I think, you know, they don't realize that a lot of people that are younger than a lot of these leaders are much more open-minded, and they are like, I don't want to be associated with these policies. And therefore, younger people are kind of staying away from places with these mindsets. And so some of these colleges may end up painting themselves to a corner where they don't have a student body, and so unless they change, they're going to be a footnote in history. Catherine, are you hearing more about that, where colleges like this are starting to drop in enrollment?
I haven't checked that, but I think that's I think it's a likely scenario as we move forward. I think a lot of these issues are much less important to the upcoming generation than they are to this, you know, generation of the leadership in this school. You know, reading this article again, they claim that they don't discriminate, but they just had to have that file, that letter on file to keep their, you know, with their religious basis of their school, but they don't discriminate. Well, then why do you, you know? But my answer is, since it is a Southern Baptist school, let the Southern Baptists pay, you know, fund it so that it doesn't have to take Title IX money. They got plenty of money.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe not enough to fund all the schools. Like places like Baylor kind of put, and Mercer have kind of pulled away from the Southern Baptist.
But you know, the bad thing, David, is just a couple of years ago, in Shorter's case, they achieved university status. And the benefits that come with it, like the increases in the athletic program and the scholarships and stuff like that, and playing better competition, drawing larger crowds. And with one fell swoop, they seem to have derailed all of that, and I just didn't see the point. For one thing,
It was changing the board.
Yeah, but for one thing, I don't think there was an influx of gay teachers wanting to crowd into Shorter and teach. You know, why attack a problem from their viewpoint when there's no problem at all? Why make that statement to start with? Was it a popularity thing? Did they think
it sounds like
it well with religious people? What was their angle?
Well, it sounds like from reading this article that they have an obligation, because they're part of the Georgia Baptist Convention, or I mean the Southern Baptist, I keep saying that, Southern Baptist Convention, they have to have this letter on file that says they requested this exemption in order to keep their, it says right here, it was a template that I signed and we filed, but frankly I thought it would probably go in a warehouse 4 blocks from the Department of Education and be stored and probably never seen or ever used.
Yeah.
That was what Jim.
So,
Gunther,
so the new president is not owning it, really. He's not really, you know, saying, "Oh, I'm in total agreement." He's kind of trying to say it's procedural. Well, I mean,
right.
We'll kind of see what comes out of this, but I would think there'd be more Supreme Court cases or more challenges to this down the road.
Yeah, but Catherine made. I was going to say one more thing about this. Catherine made a good point about federal money. You can get a Pell Grant and go there. You
right.
can get an FSEOG grant and go there. You can get a federal teaching grant and go there. That's a lot of grant money coming into that school. If these schools want to do stuff like that, fine. But let's let them be funded from other sources. Let's take their tax-exempt status away from them and let them just go their own way. How about that? Without our tax money keeping them up. How about
yeah,
that?
Let our tax money go to Georgia State University and
there
University of Georgia and the schools that you know, embrace these values.
Yeah, I mean, that may happen. It may get to be where it's much like K-12 schooling, although there's Republicans trying to change that, where public schools get public funding and private schools get private funding. And at the college level, that's really definitely not a good place for private schools to be funded by, because that's going to make them so much more expensive for students to try to afford. So, and, of course, we know public colleges are already so expensive. So we shall see. Well, Catherine, let's change gears again. And the reason I come to you first is because we've got yet another special election. This is for State House 58 in Georgia. It's in the Virginia Highland, the Midland, Midtown to the old 4th Ward. I'm not sure exactly where that is, into Capitol View and Sylvan Hills. It says it's a heavily Democratic district, but, of course, there's a Senate district that we know how that turned out. But it appears there's only 3 Democrats that filed for the race, so no Republican tried to slip in. With the Republican success, that may have been an oversight on their part. But looking at this race, Kwame Thompson, Park Cannon, and Ralph Long III have all registered. Do you know much about these contenders?
I do. Ralph Long is a perennial candidate. He ran against Senator Nan Orrock a couple elections ago. His wife ran against her last go-around, I think. I'm not sure what he does for a living, but he's, you know, a man about town. Everybody knows him. He's a little bit of a rabble-rouser, sort of. Park, I can't remember her last name. What's her last name?
Oh, and I didn't know if it was he or she. Park
is
kind of Park Cannon.
Park Cannon
yeah.
is young. She would be, if she's elected, she'd be the youngest person ever elected to the Georgia House, I think I heard. She is, I think she's from either South or North Carolina originally. She's been in Atlanta for a couple of years. I think she works in the nonprofit world. She has been... maybe I shouldn't say that. I know that she and Representative Simone Bell are friends, and I believe that Representative Bell has been helping her to some extent. It is Representative Bell's district. She resigned her seat to take a new professional position, and she's been in 3 terms. She's a great representative. She was the first black lesbian elected to a st- state house in the country. She's been a really dynamic leader in the house. She's great. She's a friend of mine. I supported her in her first election and have continued to support her. And I'm very disappointed that she is leaving. But here is the thing. This is the rub with the way our House and Senate are run here, our legislature here in Georgia. She needed a real job that paid real money, and she had to quit being a representative because the salary is just not sufficient to keep people, unless they have other, you know, like their lawyers or doctors or something where they can sustain their employment throughout the session and around the calendar. So I think we lose potentially good candidates because of that, you know, sort of ridiculous salary situation. Anyway, so I think it's going to be an interesting race. I think they called the election for January 15th or 16th or something. So it's coming up, and I don't know anything about that third candidate. I've never heard of them, so I don't know.
Yeah, so that's not your district, is it? But it's probably the
No, my district, we had our special election a couple months ago. No, it's like Midtown. It's partly DeKalb, partly Fulton. It's a very Democratic district. I haven't looked at the numbers, but it's even more Democratic, I believe, than that district that we just lost, that Senate district that we just lost.
Yes, Tim, weigh in here.
Yeah, well, a couple of caveats here. This is a House district and not a Senate district.
Right.
It's come open, House District 58. And the deal with Ralph Long is he used to be the state rep in District 61, but then they gerrymandered him out of that.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And he found himself in the district representative Bell, who he ran against and lost. So I think he was in, I don't know, maybe a couple of terms, something like that. I'm with Catherine. I don't know this third guy. I mean, I know who Kwame Thompson is, but I'm not sure about the other candidate. But as far as I can tell, Catherine is right that this district is far more Democratic than even the Senate district we just lost, where 3/4 of the voters were Democratic. This is almost like 100% slam dunk,
yeah,
type thing. And so that's about what I know about it. And I'm sad that Simone Bell is leaving. She's done a lot of traveling around the state with Valerie, and
right. Yeah.
She's a very smart and articulate person, and We hate to lose people like that out of the House, especially when we are so few in numbers, because she was a good trooper. But I certainly understand the need to get out and make a living, and at some point I hope she can jump back into the fray.
Yeah. Well, it's always these special elections. It seems like there's more of them than there used to be, but you know, got to try to mention them when they come up. And they come up, you know, it seems like there's one going on at all times now.
I know.
And, of course, so many of them are one-sided. Either it's like five Republicans or five Democrats all vying for the same seat, and there's not much chance to flip one over. But, of course, the last two or two of the last ones have come up. One was a Republican seat the Democrats won, and one was a Senate seat that was Democratic held and a Republican won. So that's why I feel like we got to mention them even more, because now they have been flipping. Well, staying in Georgia, but this is a national figure, Eric Erickson. He tweeted out that he remembers, this is how he was remembering Pearl Harbor Day. I remember growing up, my parents wouldn't even let us have Asian food. on December 7th, there were children of World War II, which is kind of funny because most Asian food, I think a lot of people eat, is probably Chinese food, and therefore it would be like Japanese food you wouldn't want to eat if you really held these feelings. But then, of course, a lot of folks aren't that nuanced to understand that Japan and China are even different countries that have these kind of feelings.
Oh, God.
I mean, really, have you never seen people that just see an Asian person, it could be Korean, Vietnamese, and go, oh, there's a Chinaman? You know, I mean, I don't see that very much anymore. But, I mean, that's the kind of mentality. It's like, oh, you're all from the continent, and China's
know,
the only country
makes,
I know.
It just makes my head hurt to hear us say that, but
it's
I
like,
think you're
it's
right.
Like, you know, it's like a dumbed-down geography lesson from Sarah Palin. Tim, what in the world was Eric Erickson sending this tweet out even? Even if it's true, why would you send it out? And then, of course, Eric Erickson's mother said, I don't remember that.
You are asking me to explain the mind of Eric Erickson?
I sure am.
A lot smarter people than me have tried that without success, okay? Who knows why he tweeted it? Obviously, the rest of his family seems to have no memory of it. And I don't know. The liberal websites, I've noticed, are having a field day with this, as well they should. I don't know. I don't know how to explain that. Maybe he was just being sarcastic or facetious, or maybe he actually thought that happened once or something. And some of the responses that he and a couple of his family members made, you know, with the religious angle and all that, got a little strange, didn't they?
Yeah, that was weird, that conversation that the reporter had with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, called up and she said, are you a Christian? I'm a Christian. And she just kind of, I guess, wanted to change the topic, if you will.
Like
she was doing.
Yeah, all they wanted was a quote on whether or not it was true. You know.
Well, I mean, and of course she could have just been like, well, I tried Asian food, Asian cuisine once, didn't really care for it, so therefore I didn't serve it. And that would have been the end of it, right? I mean, it's not, I mean, it, as long as you're like, you know, I mean, you have the right not to like certain food because of the taste. And so she could have just left it at that, right?
How about the really smart response? Hey, you'll have to ask my son about this. He's the public figure. I have no comment, period. And then that would have probably ended it right there on the spot. But,
yes, yeah. And then get on to him for tweeting out this nonsense about what they used to eat, you know, 30, 40 years ago. I don't know however long it was.
Catherine can explain Eric Erickson's mind.
Oh, no, I don't even I don't even like to listen to him, let alone try to figure out what the heck he's talking about.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, we've got 7 more minutes. We could talk about another political topic, but if y'all would like to talk about what your mamas and daddies would and would not serve growing up, I mean, you know, we can spend 7 minutes on our political form doing that. We don't want to talk about another political topic. I mean,
you know, I will
Eric
say that there was a lot of political, eating and not eating going on in my house.
Yeah, but what they served. I mean, it's kind of crazy stuff. Well, CNN's
going
to have
their
debate.
Well, I'm sure I've told you guys this before, that I don't think we had a green grape or a leaf of iceberg lettuce in my house for like a decade because of Cesar Chavez.
Good, which, of course,
you know,
a lot of folks don't know this. I try to, like a Subway sandwich, I try to eat spinach instead of lettuce because that's like no nutritional value, but that's a whole nother deal. And we've really digressed. But let's talk about this debate that CNN has coming up on Tuesday. I believe it's the final one of the year, which, my goodness, I mean, unless you're going to go on Christmas Day, there's not much time left. But it's the final one of the year, and CNN, I don't think they've announced their entire, like, who's going to be on and who's off, but
they have
announced that Rand Paul made the cutoff. Isn't that amazing to think that Rand Paul, who was seen maybe a year, a little more than that ago, as the number one contender, almost didn't even make the stage, if you will, for the, I guess, are they doing the big debate and little debate, or are they just having one debate?
No, just one debate as far as I know. Christie's made the main stage, too. That was the big announcement in the last couple of days. You know, he had been demoted. But his poll numbers have begun rising a little bit, so he's made the main stage. And I'm glad for that. He's a man of some talent, you know.
Of some talent.
Did Trump get his $5 million? Is he going to be on?
I don't know if he stood strong
to
that or not. That whole demand he made.
He's there.
I think after this Iowa poll, he has to show up whether they pay him a nickel or $5 million. You know, I don't think he can be that arrogant anymore at this point. So I guess that was a crazy story how he wanted them to donate money to what some like wounded veterans for him to appear on stage. And that was, so, I mean, it's like a debate is really not a money-making or charity opportunity. It's for you to interact as part of our democracy.
You know what, though, David? We're talking about it tonight, so Trump was successful in what he wanted to do.
Right.
But I wonder, you know, is that something that's really going to help him? I mean, I don't know that. While the average Republican in some of these states probably distrust the media, I'm not so sure that they distrust a CNN debate. That's a little bit different than editorial page and with these people. And if it all depends on where they're holding it. If they're holding it in the Reagan Library or the airport hangar of the Reagan Library, wherever they like to hold these things, you know, that might be, blasphemy if you didn't attend that.
I don't know.
So, Catherine, what did you think, Catherine?
I think that the people do believe that there's, you know, slants depending on what network. Like, I don't like to watch Fox debates because I feel like they're, you know, they have their slant to things, and I think people on the right feel that way about CNN or about MSNBC. And I think a lot depends on who's the moderator, whether they trust the debate or not.
Yeah, and I'll tell you this. Now, obviously, see, I kind of see CNN as the middle, if you will.
Okay.
I think MSNBC does slant left. Fox obviously slants right. CNN, I see, is more the middle, and they certainly, I think, try. And sometimes in Republican view, if you're the middle, you're to the left because they don't, you know, understand moderation.
Right.
But now I would say this: if I were Fox or I were MSNBC, I would try. If I was Fox, I'd try to get some real trusted Democrats. See if you could put together some kind of Democratic debate to try to broaden your audience. I'm MSNBC. I do the same. I get some trusted Republican folks and put them on there. I think MSNBC's probably done better in that. Like, I remember they had hired Stuart Stevens at one point who, ran Romney's campaign. I think they had McCain's guy for a while. I've forgotten his name. You know, they did have real Republican people to be on MSNBC. I'm not sure, other than, you know, Juan Williams, does Fox even employ any Democrats that anybody's ever heard of?
No. When is Juan Williams a Democrat?
Well, I mean, that's the closest it comes.
It didn't help Fox with Donald Trump, did it? Remember?
No.
I mean, the man is saying graphically terrible things about, you know, the female moderator of the debate and –
But
you know,
she kind of came out, as far as Fox people, I think that hurt her. I think now she could maybe demand big money from a CNN or maybe an MSNBC or ABC or something. She kind of came on the raw deal among their people, and they had to kind of take her off the air because of the way he vilified her. Very unfairly.
Yeah.
Nevertheless. Well, guys, I think that's pretty much our show for this evening. So, good show. Just three of us, no guests. I hope people enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.
Good
night, guys. Watch it. Go listen to Hamilton.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye.